Do you hear me?
Cal's heart stuttered, skipping a beat. I asked so nicely, said Vitari, his hand still buried in Kel's chest. I gave you the chance to give in. You made me use force.
Heat spread through Kel's limbs, leaving a strange cold in its wake. He heard Lila's voice, far away and stretched so thin the words, an echo of an echo, barely reached him. But he heard a name. Rai. If he died, so would Rai. He couldn't stop fighting.
I'm not going to kill you, Kel. Not exactly.
Kel squeezed his eyes shut, darkness folding over him.
Isn't there a word for this?
Lila's voice echoed through his head.
What is it?
Come on, Kel. Say the blasted word.
Kel forced himself to focus. Of course. Lila was right. There was a word. Vitari was pure magic, and all magic was bound by rules, by order. Vitari was a creation, but everything that could be created could also be destroyed. Dispelled.
As Anasai, said Kel.
He felt a glimmer of power, but nothing happened. Vitari's free hand closed around his throat.
Did you really think that would work?
Sneered the magic in Kel's shape. But there was something in his voice and in the way he tensed. Fear. It could work. It would work. It had to. But Antari magic was a verbal pact. He'd never been able to summon it with thought alone, and here, in his head, everything was thought. Kel had to say the word. He focused, reaching with his fading senses until he could feel his body not as it was here in this illusion, this mental plane, but as it was in truth. Stretched on the bitterly cold ground of the broken courtyard, Lila crouching over it. Over him. He clung to that chill, focusing on the way it pressed into his back. He struggled to feel his fingers wrapped around the stone so hard that they ached. He focused on his mouth, clenched shut in pain, and forced it to unlock. Forced his lips to part. To form the words,
Us. An.
His heart faltered as Vitari's fingers tightened around it.
No,
growled the magic, the fear bold now, twisting his impatience into anger. And Kel understood his fear. Vitari wasn't simply a spell. He was the source of all the stone's power. Dispelling him would dispel the talisman itself. It would all be over. Kel fought to hold on to his body, to himself. He forced air into his lungs and out his mouth.
Us! Anas!
He managed before Vitari's hand shifted from heart to lungs, crushing the air out of them.
You can't! Said the magic desperately. I am the only thing keeping your brother alive!
Kel hesitated. He didn't know if that was true, if the bond he'd made with his brother could be broken. But he did know that Rai would never forgive him for what he'd done, and it wouldn't even matter unless they both made it through. Kel summoned the last of his strength and focused not on Vitari trying to crush his life, or in the darkness sweeping through him, but on Lila's voice and the cold ground, and his aching fingers and his bloody lips as they formed the words.
Us. Alasai.
6. Across red London, the bodies fell. Men and women who'd been kissed or taken, wooed or forced, those who had let the magic in and those who had had it thrust upon them, all of them fell as the black flame inside them gutted and went out. Dispelled. Everywhere the magic left a trail of bodies. In the streets they staggered and collapsed. Some crumbled to ash, all burned up, and some were reduced to husks, empty inside. And a lucky few crumpled, gasping and weak but still alive. In the palace, the magic dressed as Jen had just reached the royal chambers, his blackening hand on the door, when the darkness died and took him with it. And in the sanctuary, far from the castle walls, on a bare cot in a candle-lit room, the Prince of Red London shivered and fell still. 14. The Final Door. 1. Cal opened his eyes and saw stars. They floated high above the castle walls, nothing but pricks of pale white light in the distance. The stones slipped from his fingers, hitting the ground with a dull clink. There was nothing to it now, no hum, no urge, no promise. It was just a piece of rock. Lila was saying something, and for once she didn't sound angry, not as angry as usual, but he couldn't hear her over the pounding of his heart as he brought one shaking hand to the collar of his shirt. He didn't really want to see, didn't want to know. But he tugged his collar down anyway and looked at the skin over his heart, the place where the seal had bonded Rye's life to his own. The black tracery of the magic was gone. But the scar of it wasn't. The seal itself was still intact, which meant it hadn't only been tethered to Vitari, it had been tethered to him. Kell let out a small sobbing sound of relief. And finally the world around him came back into focus. The cold stone of the courtyard and Athos's corpse, and the shards of Astrid, and Lila with her arms flung around his shoulders for an instant, and only an instant, gone before he could appreciate their presence.
"Miss me?" whispered Kell, his throat raw.
"Sure," she said, her eyes red. She towed the talisman with her boot.
"Is it dead?"
she asked. Kell picked up the stone, feeling nothing but its weight.
"You can't kill magic," said Kell, getting slowly to his feet. "Only dispel it." "But it's gone."
Lila chewed her lip.
"Do you still have to send it back?"
Cal considered the hollow rock and nodded slowly.
"To be safe," he said.
But maybe now that he was finally free of its grip, he didn't have to be the one to go with it. Cal scanned the courtyard until he saw Holland's body. In the fight, the Antari had fallen from the stone bench and now lay stretched on the ground. His blood-soaked cloak, the only sign that Holland wasn't merely sleeping. Kell got to his feet, every inch of him protesting, and went to Holland's side. He knelt and took one of the Antares' hands in his. Holland's skin was going cold, the pulse at his wrist weak and getting weaker, his heart dragging itself through the final beats. But he was still alive. "It's really quite hard to kill Antari," he had once said. It appeared he was right. Kell felt Lila hovering behind him. He didn't know if this would work, if one Antari could command for another, but he pressed his fingers to the wound at Holland's chest and drew a single line on the ground beside his body. And then he touched the hollow stone to the blood and set it on the line, bringing Holland's hand to rest on top of it.
"Peace," he said softly,
a parting word for a broken man. And then he pressed his hand on top of Holland's and said,
"As travaz."
The ground beneath the Antari gave way, bending into shadow. Kell pulled back as the darkness and whatever lay beyond swallowed Holland's body and the stone, leaving only blood-streaked ground behind. Kell stared at the stained earth, unwilling to believe that it had actually worked, that he had been spared, that he was alive, that he could go home. He swayed on his feet and Lila caught him.
"Stay with me,"
she said. Kell nodded, dizzy. The stone had masked the pain, but in its absence his vision blurred with it. Rye's wounds layered on top of his own, and when he tried to bite back a groan, he tasted blood.
"We have to go," said Kell.
Now that the city was absent a ruler or two, the fighting would start again. Someone would claw their bloody way to the throne. They always did.
"Let's get you home," said Lila.
Relief poured over him in a wave before the hard reality caught up.
"Lila," he said, stiffening, "I don't know if I can take you with me."
The stone had guaranteed her passage through the worlds, made a door for her where none should be. Without it, the chances of the world allowing her through. Lila seemed to understand. She looked around and wrapped her arms around herself. She was bruised and bleeding. How long would she last here alone? Then again, it was Lila. She'd probably survive anything.
"Well," she said, "we could try."
Kell swallowed.
"What's the worst that could happen?"
she added as they made their way to the courtyard wall.
"I get pulled into 100 little pieces between worlds."
She said it with a wry smile, but he could see the fear in her eyes.
"I'm prepared to stay, but I want to try and leave."
"If it doesn't work..."
"Then I'll find my way," said Lila.
Kell nodded and led her to the courtyard wall. He made a mark on the pale stones and dug the red London coin from his pocket. And then he pulled Lila close, wrapped his broken body around hers, and tipped his forehead against hers.
"Hey, Lila," he said softly into the space between them.
"Yeah?"
He pressed his mouth to hers for one brief moment, the warmth there, and then gone. She frowned up at him, but did not pull away.
"What was that for?"
she asked.
"For luck," he said. "Not that you need it."
And then he pressed his hand against the wall and thought of home. 2. Red London took shape around Kell, heavy with night. It smelled of earth and fire, of blooming flowers and spiced tea, and, underneath it all, of home. Kell had never been so happy to be back. But his heart sank when he realized that his arms were empty. Lila wasn't with him. She hadn't made it back. Kell swallowed and looked down at the token in his bloody hand. And then he threw it as hard as he could. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath, trying to steady himself. And then he heard a voice. Her voice.
"Never thought I'd be so happy to smell the flowers."
Kell blinked and spun to see Lila standing there, alive and in one piece.
"It's not possible," he said.
The edge of her mouth quirked up.
"It's nice to see you, too."
Kell threw his arms around her. And for a second, only a second, she didn't pull away, didn't threaten to stab him. For a second, and only a second, she hugged him back.
"What are you?"
he asked, amazed. Lila only shrugged.
"Stubborn!"
They stood there a moment, leaning on each other, one keeping the other on their feet, though neither were sure which needed more supporting. Both knew only that they were happy to be here, to be alive. And then he heard the sound of boots and swords and saw the flares of light.
"I think we're being attacked,"
whispered Lila into the collar of his coat. Kell lifted his head from her shoulder to see a dozen members of the guard surrounding them, blades drawn. Through their helmets, their eyes looked at him with fear and rage. He could feel Lila tense against him, feel her itching to reach for a pistol or a knife.
"Don't fight," he whispered,
as he slid his arms slowly from her back. He took her hand and turned toward his family's men.
"We surrender."
The guards forced Kell and Lila to their knees before the king and queen, and held them there despite Lila's muttered oaths. Their wrists were bound in metal behind them, the way Kell's had been earlier that night in Rye's chambers. Had it really been only hours? They weighed on Kell like years.
"Leave us," ordered King Maxim.
"Sir," protested one of the royal guards, shooting a glance at Kell.
"It is not safe to—"
"I said get out," he boomed. The guard withdrew, leaving only Kell and Lila on their knees in the emptied ballroom, the king and queen looming over them. King Maxim's eyes were feverish, his skin blotching with anger. At his side, Queen Amira looked deathly pale.
"What have you done?"
demanded the king. Kell cringed, but he told them the truth. Of Astrid's possession charm and the Dane twins' plan, but also of the stone and of the way he came by it and of its preceding habit. He told them of its discovery and of trying to return it to the only place it would be safe. And the king and queen listened less with disbelief than with horror, the king growing redder and the queen growing paler with every explanation.
"The stone is gone now," finished Kell, "and the magic with it."
The king slammed his fist against a banister.
"The Danes will pay for what they—"
"The Danes are dead," said Kell. "I killed them myself." Lila cleared her throat. Kell rolled his eyes.
"With Lila's help."
The king seemed to notice Lila for the first time.
"Who are you? What madness have you added to these plots?"
"My name is Delilah Bard," she shot back. "We met just earlier this evening, when I was trying to save your city, and you were standing there all blank-eyed under some kind of spell."
"Lila!" snapped Kell in horror.
"I'm half the reason your city is still standing."
"Our city?" questioned the queen. "You're not from here, then?"
Kell tensed. Lila opened her mouth, but before she could answer, he said,
"No, she's from afar."
The king's brow furrowed.
"How far afar?"
And before Kell could answer, Lila threw her shoulders back.
"My ship docked a few days ago," she announced. "I came to London because I heard that your son's festivities were not to be missed, and because I had business with a merchant named Keller in the market on the river. Kell and I have crossed paths once or twice before, and when it was clear that he needed help, I gave it."
Kell stared at Lila. She gave him a single raised brow and added,
"He promised me a reward, of course."
The king and queen stared at Lila too, as if trying to decide which piece of her story sounded least plausible. It was either the fact that she owned a ship, or the fact that a foreigner spoke such flawless English, but at last the queen's composure faltered.
"Where is our son?" she pleaded.
The way she said it, as if they had only one, made Kell flinch.
"Is Rye alive?"
demanded the king.
"Thanks to Kell," cut in Lila, "we spent the last day trying to save your kingdom, and you don't even—"
"He's alive," said Kell, cutting her off. "And he will live,"
he added, holding the king's gaze.
"As long as I do."
There was a faint challenge in the line.
"What do you mean?"
"Sir," said Kell, breaking the gaze, "I did only what I had to do. If I could have given him my life, I would have. Instead, I could only share it." He twisted in his bonds, the edge of the scar visible under his collar. The queen drew in a breath. The king's face darkened.
"Where is he, Kell?"
asked the king, his voice softening. Kell's shoulders loosened, the weight sliding from them.
"Release us," he said, "or I will bring him home."
3.
"Come in!"
Kell had never been so glad to hear his brother's voice. He opened the door and stepped into Rye's room, trying not to picture the way it had been when he last left it. The prince's blood streaked across the floor. It had been 3 days since that night, and all signs of the chaos had since been erased. The balcony had been repaired,
the blood polished out of the inlaid wood, the furniture and fabrics made new. Now Rye lay propped up in his bed. There were circles under his eyes, but he looked more bored than ill, and that was progress. The healers had fixed him up as best they could. They'd fixed Kel and Lila too, but the prince wasn't mending as quickly as he should have been. Kel knew why, of course. Rye hadn't simply been wounded, as they had been told. He'd been dead. Two attendants stood at a table nearby, and a guard sat in a chair beside the door. And all three watched Kel as he entered. Part of Rye's dark mood came from the fact that the guard was neither Parrish nor Jen. Both had been found dead, one by sword and the other by the Black Fever, as it was quickly named, that had raged through the city. A fact that troubled Rye as much as his own condition. The attendants and the guard watched Kel with new caution as he approached the prince's bed.
"They will not let me up, the bastards," grumbled Rye, glaring at them. "If I cannot leave," he said to them, "then be so kind as to leave yourselves."
The weight of loss and guilt, paired with the nuisance of injury and confinement, had put Rye in a foul humour. "By all means," he added as his servants rose, "stand guard outside. Make me feel like more of a prisoner than I already do." When they were gone, Rye sighed and slumped back against the pillows.
"They mean only to help," said Kel.
"Perhaps it wouldn't be so bad," he said, "if they were prettier to look at." But the boyish jab rang strangely hollow. His eyes found Kel's and his look darkened.
"Tell me everything," he said. "But start with this."
He touched the place over his heart where he wore a scar that matched Kel's own.
"What foolish thing have you done, my brother?"
Kel looked down at the rich red linens on the bed and pulled aside his collar to show the mirroring scar.
"I did only what you would have done, if you were me."
Rye frowned.
"I love you, Kel, but I had no interest in matching tattoos."
Kel smiled sadly.
"You were dying, Rye. I saved your life."
He couldn't bring himself to tell Rye the whole truth, that the stone hadn't only saved his life, but had restored it.
"How?" demanded the prince. "At what cost?"
"One I paid," said Kel, "and will pay again."
"Answer me without circles."
"I bound your life to mine," said Kel. "As long as I live, so shall you."
Rye's eyes widened.
"You did what?"
he whispered, horrified.
"I should get out of this bed and wring your neck."
"I wouldn't," advised Kel. "Your pain is mine, and mine is yours."
Rye's hands curled into fists.
"How could you?"
he said, and Kel worried that the prince was bitter about being tethered to him.
Instead, Rye said,
"How could you carry that weight?"
"It is as it is, Rye. It cannot be undone. So please be grateful and be done with it."
"How can I be done with it?"
scorned Rye, already slipping back into a more playful tone.
"It is carved into my chest."
"Lovers like men with scars," said Kel,
cracking a smile.
"Or so I've heard."
Rye sighed and tipped his head back, and the two fell into silence. At first it was an easy quiet, but then it began to thicken, and just when Kel was about to break it, Rye beat him to the act.
"What have I done?" he whispered,
amber eyes cast up against the gossamer ceiling.
"What have I done, Kel?"
He rolled his head so he could see his brother.
"Holland brought me that necklace. He said it was a gift, and I believed him. Said it was from this London, and I believed him."
"You made a mistake, Rye. Everybody makes them. Even royal princes. I've made many. It's only fair that you make one."
"I should have known better."
"I did know better," he added,
his voice cracking.
He tried to sit up and winced. Kell urged him back down.
"Why did you take it?" he asked when the prince was settled.
For once, Rye would not meet his gaze. "Holland said it would bring me strength."
Kell's brow furrowed.
"You are already strong."
"Not like you. That is, I know I'll never be like you, but I have no gift for magic, and it makes me feel weak. One day I'm going to be king. I wanted to be a strong king."
"Magic does not make people strong, Rye. Trust me. And you have something better. You have the people's love."
"It's easy to be loved. I want to be respected, and I thought..."
Rye's voice was barely a whisper.
"I took the necklace. All that matters is that I took it."
Tears began to escape, running into his black curls.
"And I could have ruined everything. I could have lost the crown before I ever wore it. I could have doomed my city to war or chaos or collapse."
"What sons our parents have," said Kell gently. "Between the two of us, we'll tear the whole world down."
Rye let out a stifled sound between a laugh and a sob.
"Will they ever forgive us?"
Kell mustered a smile.
"I am no longer in chains. That speaks to progress."
The king and queen had sent word across the city by guard and scrying board alike that Kell was innocent of all charges. But the eyes in the street still hung on him, wariness and fear and suspicion woven through the reverence. Maybe when Rye was well again and could speak to his people directly, they would believe he was all right and that Kell had had no hand in the darkness that had fallen over the palace that night.
Maybe, but Kell doubted it would ever be as simple as it had been before.
"I meant to tell you," said Rye. "Tyrion came to visit. He brought some..."
He was interrupted by a knock at the door. Before either Rye or Kell could answer, Lila stormed into the room. She was still wearing her new coat, patches sewn over the spots where it had been torn by bullet and blade and stone, but she'd been bathed at least, and a gold clasp held the hair out of her eyes. She still looked a bit like a starved bird, but she was clean and fed and mended.
"I don't like the way the guards are looking at me,"
she said before glancing up and seeing the prince's gold eyes on her.
"I'm sorry," she added. "I didn't mean to intrude."
"Then what did you mean to do?"
challenged Kell. Rye held up his hand.
"You are surely not an intrusion,"
he said, pushing himself up in the bed,
"though I fear you've met me rather out of my usual state of grace. Do you have a name?" "Delilah Bard," she said. "We've met before, and you looked worse."
Rye laughed silently.
"I apologize for anything I might have done.
I was not myself." "I apologize for shooting you in the leg," said Lila. "I was myself entirely."
Rye broke into his perfect smile.
"I like this one," he said to Kell. "Can I borrow her?"
"You can try," said Lila, raising a brow. "But you'll be a prince without his fingers."
Kell grimaced, but Rye only laughed. The laughter quickly dissolved into wincing, and Kell reached out to steady his brother, even as the pain echoed in his own chest.
"Save your flirting for when you're well," he said.
Kell pushed to his feet and began to usher Lila out.
"Will I see more of you, Delilah Bard?" called the prince.
"Perhaps our paths will cross again."
Rye's smile went crooked.
"If I have any say in it, they will."
Kell rolled his eyes, but thought he caught Lila actually blushing as he guided her out and shut the door, leaving the prince to rest. 4.
"I could try and take you back," Kell was saying, "to your London."
He and Lila were walking along the river's edge past the evening market, where people's eyes still hung too heavy and too long, and farther on toward the docks. The sun was sinking behind them, casting long shadows in front of them like paths. Lila shook her head and pulled the silver watch from her pocket.
"'There's nothing for me there,' she said, snapping the timepiece open and shut. "'Not any more.'
"'You don't belong here either,' he said simply.
She shrugged. "'I'll find my way.' And then she tipped her chin up and looked him in the eyes. "'Will you?'
The scar over his heart twinged Dolly, a ghost of pain, and he rubbed his shoulder.
"'I'll try.'
He dug a hand in the pocket of his coat, the black one with the silver buttons, and withdrew a small parcel.
"'I got you something.'
He handed it over and watched Lila undo the wrappings of the box, then slide the lid off. It fell open in her hand, revealing a small puzzle board and a handful of elements.
"'For practice,' he said. "'Tyrion says you've got some magic in you. "'Better find it.'
They paused on a bench, and he showed her how it worked, and she chided him for showing off, and then she put the box away and said thank you. It seemed to be a hard phrase for her to say, but she managed. They got to their feet, neither willing to walk away just yet, and Kell looked down at Delilah Bard, a cutthroat and a thief, a valiant partner and a strange, terrifying girl. He would see her again. He knew he would. Magic bent the world, pulled it into shape. There were fixed points. Most of the time those points were places, but sometimes, rarely, they were people. For someone who never stood still, Lila still felt like a pin in Kell's world, one he was sure to snag on. He didn't know what to say, so he simply said,
"'Stay out of trouble.'
She flashed him a smile and said she wouldn't, of course. And then she tugged up her collar, shoved her hands into her pockets and strolled away. Kell watched her go. She never once looked back. Delilah Bard was finally free. She thought of the map back in London, grey London, her London, old London. The parchment she'd left in the cramped little room at the top of the stairs in the stone's throw. The map to anywhere. Isn't that what she had now? Her bones sang with the promise of it. Tyrion had said there was something in her, something untended. She didn't know what shape it would take, but she was keen to find out. Whether it was the kind of magic that ran through Kell or something different, something new, Lila knew one thing. The world was hers. The worlds were hers. And she was going to take them all. Her eyes wandered over the ships on the far side of the river, their gleaming sides and carved masts tall and sharp enough to pierce the low clouds. Flags and sails flapped in the breeze in reds and golds, but also greens and purples and blues. Boats with royal banners and boats without. Boats from other lands across other seas, from near and far, wide and away. And there, tucked between them, she saw a proud dark ship with polished sides and a silver banner and sails the colour of night. A black that hinted at blue when it caught the light just so. That one, thought Lila with a smile. That one'll do. This concludes A Darker Shade of Magic by Victoria Schwab, narrated by Stephen Crossley. Copyright 2015 by Victoria Schwab. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Victoria Schwab, care of the Waxman Literary Agency, and was produced in the year 2015 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.